It's All Things Considered on 91.9 FM WUOT. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. Andrew Jackson died in 1845, but somewhere his ears must be burning. This week, Tennessee Democratic Party Chair Mary Mancini said it was time to have a discussion about removing Jackson's name from the party's annual Jefferson Jackson Day dinner. And this year, there have been other such conversations nationwide about the legacy of the 7th president. Dan Feller is a professor of history at the University of Tennessee and director of the university's effort to catalog and publish Jackson's papers. Feller says he thinks the time is right for Mary Mancini's proposed conversation.
I'm not surprised that it was proposed, and I was actually pleased to see that what Ms. Mancini proposed was a conversation, and I think a conversation about Andrew Jackson and about American history in general and how we ought to approach it and what we ought to do with our knowledge of it is always appropriate. This comes in the wake, of course, of the $20 bill controversy, which is itself not new. There have been periodic efforts to take Jackson off the 20 over a number of years.
Mary Mancini, the chairman of the Tennessee Democratic Party, said her idea for this, to have this discussion, was motivated in part because other states that held Jackson Day dinners have dropped Jackson's name. And you and I talked a little earlier on the phone about this as we were setting up this interview. You said you weren't surprised that some of those states have dropped Jackson's name.
Actually, I was surprised to learn that Tennessee hadn't. What used to be called the Jefferson Jackson Day was a prominent day for a long time on the Democratic Party calendar. And Jackson was dropped from that in a number of states. And it generally has been dropped from the Democratic pantheon because of Indian removal. Really, it all comes down to Indian removal. And it has now been true for a generation, not just yesterday. If you look at, let's say, an eighth grade American history textbook, what you mainly learn about Andrew Jackson is Indian removal. And I have known for years that when I identify myself as a Jackson expert, people immediately come back with something about the Indians. The idea that Jackson is primarily important for his Indian policy is actually a generation old, and Democrats, Americans, have been shying away from him for some time for that reason.
Well, to present a little a balance into the picture, too, Mary Mancini said in her statement earlier this week, she says, yes, we don't like his record on slavery. We don't like the idea of the Indian removal, the forcible removal back in the 1820s and 30s. But we're still talking about one of the founders of the modern Democratic Party. Jackson is a seminal figure at the beginning of the Democratic Party in this country.
Indeed. And she did acknowledge what is sometimes lost in this discussion. Let me say I'm not a particular defender of Andrew Jackson.
Right, right.
As the editor of his papers, my mission is to present the fullest and most definitive record possible so that we can have an informed debate as opposed to an uninformed one.
Right.
And an informed debate about Jackson's administration would certainly acknowledge a lot of things that don't look pretty to us. It would also acknowledge that he was, and this is, I think, fact, the first president of the United States to speak directly in behalf of what today we would call ordinary working families. One time the phrase was the common man. Jackson's own phrase was the farmer, the laborer, the mechanic. Against the interests of what he called, and this is his phrase again, the rich and powerful. And perhaps the most enduring single sentence that Jackson uttered as president in his veto of the Bank of the United States was it, and I can do this from memory, it is to be regretted that the rich and powerful too often bend the acts of government to their selfish purposes.
That sounds like a phrase we would hear on the campaign trail today.
It does, and this is an important element in American politics, has been ever since. This is why the populists in the 1890s, this is why Woodrow Wilson and Democrats in the progressive era, this is why Franklin Roosevelt and John F. Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson loved to quote Andrew Jackson. That's part of his legacy, too, and Ms. Mancini did recognize that.
Well, there's at least one person who is not happy about the idea of the discussion. That's State Representative Darren Jernigan of Nashville. Now, why would he be upset about this? Well, Turns out the Hermitage, Andrew Jackson's home, is located in his district, and he said earlier this week that he thinks even having the conversation is troublesome for the party. You're a man, Dr. Feller, who has studied not just Andrew Jackson, but what people say about Andrew Jackson for a long time. You've probably heard more of the arguments than any of us ever will out here in the listening audience. How do you think this debate is going to shape up?
How it's going to shape up and how I wish it would shape up, unfortunately, appear to be two different things. Mm-hmm. First, let me say I kind of sympathize with Mr. Jernigan and with the Hermitage. They are, frankly, in a position that I'm not. I'm a scholar. My only interest is in having an informed conversation. Andrew Jackson is a hometown boy in Nashville. The Hermitage is a historic site, and by the way, a very good historic site, which has a new exhibit, which presents the debate about Andrew Jackson, I think, rather well. But if the tendency of that debate is to say this is a terrible guy and we ought to be embarrassed by him, that does not bode well for the Hermitage as a tourist site, which wants to attract visitors. And why would you go there if you think he's a terrible guy? I would have hoped, let's take the Indian removal issue, that bringing this issue to the fore again would prompt us to look at the issue in a wider scope, to realize that it's not just about Jackson, that Jackson's responsibility for some of the more egregious and shocking and indefensible consequences of that policy, that his responsibility for that is real. But it's not sole responsibility. This is a national problem. And by the way, our interest in it today, and this is perfectly good, I think we are mainly interested in this today because we have today an appreciation of the fact that the problem of relations between Native Americans and the rest of Americans has not been solved. And you go back and you say, okay, how do we get to where we are? And Andrew Jackson is part of that answer. He's not the only answer. And unfortunately, I realize I'm giving a long answer here. That's what academics do. Unfortunately, instead of the debate so far leading to a more full understanding of all the issues involved, it seems to have been leading the other way. As an example of this, the New York Times ran an editorial several weeks ago. And the editorial said we really ought to get Jackson off the 20 because, it said, his policies annihilated the Southeastern Indians. I don't know what other word to use. This is just false. Mm-hmm. It did not annihilate the Southeastern Indians. It forcibly expelled them. Mm-hmm. And within that forcible expulsion, a lot of people suffered a great deal, and some of them died through neglect and heedlessness and incompetence and corruption. But annihilating means killing. Yeah. That was never the intent of the policy. That was never the result of the policy. And it is disturbing to me when the only way we can debate things, and not only this thing, is to reduce them to sound bites, which oversimplify to the point of falsifying.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see how this debate takes shape over the next few weeks within the Tennessee Democratic Party. Dr. Daniel Feller is the director of the Jackson Papers Project here at the University of Tennessee and an expert on all things Jackson that we like to talk to whenever the man himself is in the news. Dr. Feller, thank you so much for being with us on All Things Considered.
Thank you. It is always a pleasure.